My name is William. I'm an addict. And I would like to thank the Chesapeake Potomac CNP Regional 24th Convention for just taking the risk that asking me to speak one more time and to share my experience, strength, and hope with you. It talks about share your experience and not your opinion. I'm 66 years old, so all my life, my opinion sometimes is my experience. So I try not to cheat myself, and so you may hear my opinion as well as my experience in my sharing, and I'm talking about me, how I got here one day at a time. When I got here, I was told, do not forget your last high. But mine was, don't forget your last hit. And what it was, you know, in the beginning, I have to identify in it. Well, in this, you're going to hear me, my experience is going to be talking about the jails, my family, my connection to the program, my first meeting and how I identified out and had to return again and again and again. And then in 1997, November the 21st, I've been clean ever since. And only through the grace of God and the people that came before me or was coming at the same time I was coming was I able to get this thing this time. And what y'all told me was I don't ever have to use again, and I heard that a whole lot tonight, that I don't ever have to use again. So I don't have a choice. You know, my desire is not to get high anymore. I just don't want to go back to my final day. And in the end, I was homeless, I was penniless, I was broke, and I was a bum. In the beginning, I had a 3-bedroom townhouse. I'm from Baltimore, Maryland. I'm often fed in Schroeder Street. They say these things don't mean nothing, but I got to identify him because the house was my biggest enabler in the end and in the beginning, because I remember going into treatment and they told me that, William, maybe you need to let the house go. And that was my first time going in. Maybe you need to let the house go. And I said, the house is all I got. It's my financial means. It's all that I got. I had a picket fence, I had the dog, and I had a family. And in the end, the picket fence is still standing there, but the house is no longer there. So in the end, the house had to go, and I lost everything. And I ended up, for the first time, I want to say the same thing that's been, surrender was my process. And what surrender meant to me was when I was first told that you need to surrender, which is the first step, one of the spiritual principles. And not only do you need to surrender, but you need to get honest with you. So honesty is where I come from. And so my story tonight is just about me and how I struggle with the disease of addiction and how at this point I'm grateful for the rooms of Narcotics Anonymous and you people. And I don't want to say, see, when I was little, you people was a bad word, especially for black folks, you know. I don't know about y'all. You know, white folks used to say you peoples, right? So y'all going to hear my story. See, I'm going to talk about me. I got 66 years of some experience that if you haven't had this experience, you just need to thank your higher power. But my experience may not be yours. So don't be offended, but let me just talk about me and how I got through my process and where I'm at today. I ended up in 1997 in a town called Fred Rock. And that's called Fred Rock, Maryland. Now, for you people that's from up north, y'all gonna say it's south. But what I was told, you know, in order to know about the south, you first got to get in the south and then go north. So in order, I'm trying to tell you, some of y'all already been north, but you came from the south too. But I'm okay with where I was in the south, right? So what happened is that, I was born, I truly believe that God blessed me with to say that my disease started long before I picked up the drug. I was this little boy. The confusion with this little boy is you're going to hear me talk about William today, but I need to tell you about Bobby in order for you to get to know William. Bobby is the person that you really, really haven't met. And in this program, what y'all told me was I had to let Bobby go and become William. And it took me 53 years to say that my name is William William F. and not Bobby F. Confusing, ain't it? All right, let me get you there then. Jails, institutions, and death. At the age of 11, when I first knew or first thought I had a problem, my first problem in my life, my first disease that told me, man, I grew up being a people pleaser. And what it was, I was always this little guy that my father would punish me for the least little thing that I did. And what happened with me coming up and everything, I always got out, I was always let out the yard on Christmas Day. But I never had toys, so my father didn't believe in Christmas, so he didn't buy me gifts. And in getting out the yard, what's happening is that I was this little bad guy. So here come little Tony down the street with his scooter, and I ain't got no scooter. So I punch little Tony in the mouth, takes his scooter, and go home with it, and then my father whoops my ass, and he puts me in the yard again. And what it was, I found out all this time, man, not only was I this little bad guy, I was this manipulated guy, I was this little thief, I was this little boy that's just going to grow up to be this guy, you know, this real dangerous person. And to bring you up to fourth, by the time I was 19, my last bit was I was sentenced to life in 43 years in the Maryland Penitentiary. And how I identify that I've been in the penitentiary, just in case some of y'all really want to check me out, my number was 10726. I was a 726th inmate to become a part of the diagnostic system in the Maryland Penitentiary. I remember that system real well because no longer was they wearing blue jeans. They had us in white coveralls, and they sent me to the penitentiary. And when I went to the penitentiary, I ended up in A block, but for the next 15 years, I slept in B block. So in the process of going to prison, at some point or another, there was this God that everybody talks about now that called a spiritual God and not a religious God, but I always thought it was the religious God that freed me, but it was this power greater than myself that loved me better than I loved myself. But I was only to begin to learn this and understand this. My experience was I practiced religion, but religion did not work for me. I prayed every day. I done been through the whole system. I done been baptized, slapped down, stomped everything else. But God did not come to me in that reality. The reality part of it was when I smoked crack cocaine, and I ended up on that last day, November the 21st. And I remember this. I had $5. I didn't have the hundreds that I used to have. I couldn't get the package that I'm used to getting. And I remember that they were selling nickel valves, and they were called red tops. And I remember asking the guy, give me a red top, and that's my last $5. And whatever he gave me was not what I'm used to. I didn't get the sweats. I didn't get to the keyhole. I didn't get to the mail slot. I didn't nail nothing up to the windows at this time, so I'm all messed up here. What the fuck did you give me? What happened? It just didn't react. And I know I was feeling that I needed something, and I needed it, and I needed it. But I done tried this 1,000 times. What happened was it brought me to my knees. And at that point, because I didn't have no more money, and I'm the chump. Now, I'm not going to stick you up and rob you today. After I done got out of the penitentiary for serving 15 years. The hell with me robbing somebody going back to jail. I wasn't ready for that one. But in this process was, what happened on that night was, I remember a friend telling me, after I had been in treatment 5 times, they said that whenever you're ready, Bobby, we have a bed for you one more time. And that was in 1995 when they told me that, after I had used on my 90-day vent. See, what I do, I would get high. And then when I go in and get clean, I get clean for 90 days. And that's all I was doing. Well, I stopped using for 90 days. 90 days. 90 days. I was good at 90 days. I could do that real good. But I could not get past 90 days. But this time, y'all told me that I had to do something that I'd never done before. And that was make a decision on what do I want to do. Do I want to live or do I want to die in active addiction the way I was going? Do I want my family back, or do I want to let my family go? Do I want to be this real guy that I talks about, this loving and caring guy that I am today? Y'all know that, right? I'm very loving and caring today. In the beginning, I won't when I came in the room, so when I get to that, you're going to see it. What happened was, man, when I went and asked for this help this time, I was told that if you don't get it this time, Bobby, there's nothing else we can do for you. I'm going to send you to a place one more time where there's people just like you. And what you got to do is allow them people who just like you to help you. Do that ring a bell to anybody?
Hell
yeah. Okay. I like this one here. The thing what I didn't get out of that was by the institution that I was going to, and it was a member of, I thought they were going to send me to a spiritual retreat up in the mountains where there was people who knew this God that we always talk about that could help me and help me and help me. And it didn't work out that when I prayed for God, you know, just let me go to this retreat and get well and be able to do all these things to be this father and everything. And what happened was they took me back up in the mountains to the treatment center that I left 2 years ago and told me, this is the place where you got to get it at. And I ended up in this treatment center one more time. In this process, there was a community of 18 addicts in that community, a very small community. And when I came in that community this time, something changed me. Something gave me some hope. And somebody loved me better than I loved myself. And it was total strangers. There was addicts from New York, New Jersey, Chicago, you name it. They was all in this institution. And they met Bobby. On the day that they met Bobby, I went in to see my counselor. I pulled out all my paperwork, my birth certificate and everything. And my counselor asked me one question, and I still today don't know how to answer that question. Who is Bobby? I'm Bobby. Who is Bobby? I'm Bobby. Do you see the stubbornness in me? He says, your birth certificate says you're William. You're William F. And what happened was, after he decided that I was going to be William, he gave me this sign, and he told me to go back out into community and walk around with this sign for the next week saying, I'm William. Everybody I hug, I'm William. Did I do it? Yes. Why did I do it? I don't know. Y'all said that in the beginning, I had to find a power greater than myself that could help me with my uselessness, all of this. My first step was my powerless now. I'm a powerless person. But for some reason, the 18 people there was a better person than me because they loved me better than I was loving myself because I'm telling you, my father used to say, a hard head makes a soft ass. Well, that's what I learned. And in this process, again with my experience, through going to jail, through being sexually molested as a little boy by men, through harming people, through neglecting my family, through abandoning my family, and losing a wife in this process, I finally decided that I would surrender, but I didn't know what I was surrendering to. My experience was that I love crack cocaine like I love nothing else. It became something that I just needed a hit, not to feel what I was feeling, but I couldn't understand what the feelings was. And the feelings was, William, when is you going to learn something from this? You lost everything. You lost your family. All of this had to go. Give us a reason why you keep going this way. And why do you want to continue on going this way? I never thought people loved me. I can't tell you that my father was a good father in the beginning. My story was for you to hear this sad story of how brutal he was to me and how he beat me and how he stomped me. And I wanted you to feel sorry. I wanted you to feel my pain because no child deserved this. At least this is what I was telling myself. until I did some step work. The first step talks about powerlessness. I'm a good liar. Sometimes I'm just powerless over lying. I just lie to be lying. So what happened was, in this process, in my first three steps, a lot of lies was told until I got to the fourth step. And I had a sponsor who told me, I really don't know who you is, William. Why don't you do your fourth step and let it be a moral inventory of just you? And how he described what a moral inventory was, it meant that I must do a complete inventory of myself. Don't call him and ask him who William is. You tell me who William is. The fourth step is for you to do, and when you do it, you must do it as honestly as possible you can. And at that point, my experience was, when I came to Narcotics Anonymous, I really didn't want to fucking be here. Y'all wasn't the people that I wanted to be with. I walked away from a lot of meetings. I smoked a lot of crack. I did a lot of drinking. I did a lot of weed. I did a lot of everything, man, to get here. But I just didn't think that y'all could help me. From this process, man, in the fourth step, man, I was able to deal with me and to tell y'all some things about me that I just wanted y'all to know this time, because they say honesty, Joe, is the, you know, the key to this here. This is the combination to this here. Even though I was molested, it was something that I did and not that somebody did to me. Had I stayed home and went in my house and laid down like my father always tell me to go to bed, boy, instead of leaving and wanting to hang out with the other guys and then sleep over this guy's house and then his brother molests me, I wouldn't have never been in that position. So it had nothing. So I'm not the victim in this here. And what I had to do was tell y'all, man, that what happened to me was I ran away from home. And I took a chance of sleeping in a total stranger house. And that's what happened to me. So I'm not the victim of that. Molested I was. I can't use that as a crutch in Narcotics Anonymous to try to make somebody else seem like they're the most baddest guy in the world when it's me too. My process was, every time I went to jail, man, I went to jail for horrible things. I did things at the age of 19. And I don't like lying to you, but I became so vicious that if you did something to me, I would kill you. And it got to the point to where it wasn't just trying to say that I was bad, but I was not bad, but I became this monster, man. Like something inside of me just took over, and the disease told me that I could harm people, until God stepped in there. And when he stepped in, man, he sent me to penitentiary. And he sent me to the penitentiary that I said that I don't think I would ever get out again. But y'all told me in this process, man, prayer changes things. I ain't talking about a religious prayer. I'm talking about a prayer of understanding that there is a God and he's not me. I'm talking about today the same God that I'm talking about. I no longer get high because this God tells me that I don't have to. You know, I don't have to use today. I don't have to come in here and lie to you and ask you to accept me for who I am. All I have to do is accept me. At least that's what my sponsor told me. Learn to love you and then learn to love God. And once God, you learn God, love God, and you love yourself, then maybe God will give you something back that you want so bad. And all I wanted to do was be a good family person. I had a wife. I got a wife today. For the people that know me, I have a little lady that loved me, man. I met her in 1972, and she visited me in the penitentiary for 11 years as a friend. She gave me a place to stay when I got out. We've been together for 38 years. We've only been married for 5. But even out of all the good things that she did for me and all the good things she gave me, I was still this abusive guy. I was the best whore in town. I did a lot of things to her to make her leave me, but for some reason, she chose not to leave. And she would always say to me, you know, when Bobby comes out, you're just a different person. You understand what I'm saying, Arlene? And I asked her to describe this, and I described this. This happened in the rooms of Narcotics Anonymous, my experience. When I came here, man, I'm telling you what y'all did to me, man. Y'all punished me. Y'all fuck with me, man, and then when I fuck with you back, you call the police on me. I'm facing 10 fucking years. Again, that's what y'all did to me. If you don't fuck with me, I won't do these things. Excuse my expression. They say you don't curse, but I got to express this because, you know, that's what I was. I was a cursor at that time. Leave me the fuck alone. And then when I got to fighting in the room when they called the police, what it was I fell in love with a girl in the rooms of Narcotics Anonymous. You know how y'all is. Once y'all get to a certain point, you know, y'all take advantage of me. You understand what I'm saying? See, when I fall in love with you and you don't want me no more, then when I get to be this other guy, then you want to call the police and everybody won't make me the bad guy. So relationships for me was a problem in the beginning until the police came. Then the first step kicked in. You're powerless, William. You're going back to jail. Do you want to go again? Surrender. The honest thing about this is tell the truth. And what I found out was, for me in the three relationships with the women in the room that I had, and I'm talking about, they said sick people is attracted to sick people. I had three sick motherfuckers. These women drove me out of my mind for some reason. And what they told me, too, is this is why I relate to this, man. After I stopped smoking crack, right? The reason I wanted the women in the room because I remember when y'all were coming to my house and knocking on the door, and I got this package. And then we sit there and smoke this package up, and then y'all turn around and leave. So here I am standing here with this sexual desire that I done smoked all this crack and I ain't gonna do nothing, but I still wanna do something. So the dream is that you will come back one day. And what I found out the day that you came back was the day that I got clean. So I said, nah, I'm gonna give you the best sex you ever had. And what I found out was, man, sex was a drug for me. Especially if it was good. It brought something out of me. And I began to do things in the rooms that was unbelievable of me because I just told you that I had a woman that was good to me and happy with me and everything like that. But I just wanted to try y'all out. And my sponsor told me, you don't have a clue what a healthy relationship is. Why don't you leave these women alone? He didn't tell me that once. He told me that twice. He told me that three times. And the last time, it clicked. See, the last time was you put your hand on me. And once you put your hand on me, that gives me the opportunity to open up the doors. I got a right to put my hands back on you now. Don't touch me. But I didn't. I got where I'm at, they lock you up for assault. You know, you can go to jail in recovery, William. I had to learn. Thank you. So I didn't put my hands back on you. What God did for me, man, God again sent me back to the rooms, man. And I asked the rooms and I started asking questions, what's wrong with me? And the clue of it was for me to have my experience in an unhealthy relationship was I didn't tell you the truth about me from the beginning. I didn't tell you that I'm insecure. I'm very jealous. And once you're mine and mine's only. I own you now. Once we kiss, once we lay down, once it get good and I scream and holler at you, there's no turning back. You're mine. But the euphoria wore off. You know what I mean? It was just like smoking the crack. We used to do it the same way every day, every day, every day. And then one day, I couldn't do it that way anymore. And she asked a simple question. Let me tie you up to the bedpost. I don't have no experience in that. So I let that go, and I let her go. What I did, man, was my process was I came into the rooms of Narcotics Anonymous with a lot of baggage, a lot of misinformation, and I used it. Gotcha. I'm going to see my sponsor. He's even giving me orders now. Gotcha. You sure? Okay. All right. But what I'm saying to y'all is that my experience is that when I came here, man, I was not clean. I did not know how to stay clean. Y'all gave me an opportunity to do this thing one more time. Y'all showed me that if I don't use the drug, my process would become a lot easier, but the same things would start to appear, and all I had to do was pray. That sixth step, and started asking God that I'm entirely ready to move on to the next. So what I don't do today, what I got, let me tell you, the very woman that I told y'all who I was abusive to and treated around, she's my wife today. What I got today is I got my children back in my life. See, I have five girls. What I got today, I'm a grandfather today. Not only am I a grandfather, I'm a father. And now I'm a great-grandfather four times too. My problem is that I can't have nothing but girls in my family. I don't know how to make boys and don't look like the girls know how to make boys. So that, you know, so I got a big family. I got 23 grandchildren and four great. The program gave me my children back. They gave me my family back. My experience was that you had a lot going on, Arlene and Sheree. Y'all had some that I wanted. And the only way I was going to get it was do some things that y'all told me to do. And don't use. My process was that William was going to do this thing his way until he realized that without the help of the rooms of Narcotics Anonymous, without the peoples in the rooms of Narcotics Anonymous, without service work, and without me surrendering and letting y'all help me, I would have never understood what my God wanted for me. My God wanted for me to have the best that I could have. So he put me with the best peoples in the world. He put me with peoples who had the same problem that I had. And y'all showed me that I can live one day at a time without the use of drugs. And nothing could ever interfere with me if I don't pick the drug up. That whatever God got for me, y'all will show me how to get to God and understand that just for today, God allowed me to stand here one more time in a room full of addicts and share my experience, strength, and hope. Step work, sponsorship, networking, and service work. Without those key, without those things in my life now, I believe that I would be back out there using again. Narcotics Anonymous has given me something that I'm very grateful for. Thanks for allowing me to share.
I'd like to introduce our second speaker, Brenda W. from the South Potomac area. All right.
I'm Brenda and I'm an addict. This the one I'm talking into, right?
Yes.
Okay. You can't? Don't say that. Don't start. Thank you, William, for sharing. And I really enjoyed just sharing. I when I heard this topic, it was like, that's something serious. That's some grown-up stuff. You know, that's some stuff I probably need to do some research on, right? And I always talk about to my sponsor when I have to share. My sponsor said the best thing you do is share your story. And but I did do some research about, I had to look up some words. That's what y'all taught me to do when I came in here. So this is what an opinion is. It's a subjective statement or thought about an issue or topic, and is the result of emotion or interpretation of facts. An opinion may be supported by an argument, although people may draw opposing opinions from the same set of facts. Opinions rarely change without new arguments being presented. However, it can be reasoned that one opinion is better supported by the facts than another by analyzing the supporting arguments. An opinion may be the result of a person's perspective, understanding, particular feelings, beliefs, and desire. In casual use, the term opinion may refer to unsubstantiated information in contrast to knowledge and fact-based beliefs. Okay. Experience is a general concept comprises knowledge of a skill in or observation of something of some event gained through involvement in or exposure to that thing or event. Okay. That's the difference. Okay. I'm going to take my gum out of my mouth. So having said all that, I'm going to just share my story, you know, and I have a number too, William. I didn't get mine through jail, but my number is I'm one of seven children, you know. I'm number three, third girl, one of four girls, and I'm a Washington, D.C. native. My parents were young parents. By the time my mother was 21, she had five children, and seven altogether, like I said earlier. We had a lot of family around. They partied, they played cards, they drank. You know, we cleaned up after them. We dibbled and dabbed in it. I was happy when the party was going on because my parents talked. They laughed together when they were partying. During the week, they ain't say nothing to each other. Saturday and Sunday, it was on, you know, and they loved each other. They hugged. We saw them hugging and kissing and partying and laughing. And so that was a good time for me to see them do what they needed to do. And like I said, it was a lot of us. My mother is one of nine children, so we had cousins and aunts. And, I mean, we had we all just family all the time. And with that came a lot of mischief, too. My parents, my father was in the military. He was very rigid, and we had to get up every day, and we had a regiment. Get up, wash your face, brush your teeth, comb your hair, get ready for school, eat your breakfast, and get on out of here. Come home, change your clothes, clean up. You know, it was always regimented. And I couldn't wait to get away from that, man. It was too much structure. And I wanted to be free. Like, other children, it seemed like they had to do what we had to do, you know. And the thing about my parents that, like I said, they were young, and they were a little permissive, and they, like, allowed us to have, you know, like, wine at the table for dinner, because they thought the wine that they was giving us was, innocent. You know, it wasn't strong. It was like Kool-Aid to them, like T.J. Swan or something. I don't know what it was. But anyway, you know, and I probably was about 11 or 12, and they thought that that was really okay. And it might have been for normal people. I'm not normal. So when they would leave out the house, I would sneak into their liquor. And one particular time, it was New Year's Eve, they had went somewhere, and I mixed all the liquor on the bar, and I drank it all. And I was so violently ill. I mean, I was throwing my guts up and everything. And when they came home, my mother said, well, what's wrong with you? And my tattletale sister, Carolyn, she told them she drank all, she mixed all that stuff. My mother said, do you know you could have died? And the only lesson I learned was don't mix all your liquor. It wasn't don't drink no more, don't mix it. You know, that's the only lesson I got out of that. And so, you know, I went on and we left Northeast. We was in Northeast D.C. and went over to Southwest. I was living on Bowling Air Force Base. And I met my first boyfriend on Bowling Air Force Base. Bowling Air Force Base was like a community inside of a community. We had everything down there. We had bowling, movies, swimming pools, dances. I mean, it was just so much fun being down there. And then the drugs came, and I had my first hit of marijuana when I was on that base. And it was from my soon-to-be boyfriend who was living across the road in Southeast. And they came down on the base, and I was introduced to marijuana. And that was the funnest night I had. I had so much fun. We laughed, we giggled, and everything, right? And that was the beginning. And I ain't had to have it no more for 6 months, a year. I don't even know how long it was, you know. But soon the days started getting closer and closer, you know. And I wanted to hang with this dude so bad because he was cool. My father was a, like I said, a military guy. He had a uniform on, pressed and starched, and he walked with a briefcase. And, you know, so that wasn't attractive to me. I'm a good girl, and I like bad boys. You know, and so this guy was bad. You know, he could cuss, and he walked with a pimp like this, you know, had his hat cocked to the side. He cut class, you know, I learned how to cut class and everything, right? And he told me, you know, if you're going to hang out with me, you got to talk. I was kind of, I enunciated my words properly. And he would say, if you're going to hang with me, you got to talk like me. You know, it's not shit, it's shit, you know. Not motherfucker, it's motherfucker, you know. And I wanted to hang with him, so I had to do what he did. And, you know, and so because I wanted to be a part of something. I wanted to be something that I wasn't. And you know, so we went through high school together, and I graduated. The night I graduated, everybody pretty much in my class went to prom. I went to the hotel and snorted my first thing of coke, you know. And I remember I sneezed after I snorted it. You don't be sneezing around this stuff. That's how you talk to me, right? I was like, what's so serious about that? Ain't nothing but some powder. You know, I didn't know, right? And that's the choices that I would make. I would choose drugs and that kind of lifestyle over doing the right thing. And I went to work. I had a job and with the government. And it was a guy at the Treasury Department. You couldn't come out the Treasury Department once you went in there. During the day, you went to work, you couldn't come out. You had to be signed out because it was money being made in there, you know. And but it was people in there selling drugs. And they used to sell $10 bags of coke. And by the end of payday, I owed about my whole check. You know, the whole check. And so, you know, my addiction was progressing, and I didn't see it. And at the end, I was smoking crack, and I was snorting dope. And I always thought people that did dope was junkies, because that's what I read about. I read that y'all was junkies. Little did I know I was a junkie, you know. And I remember the end of my addiction, I was so miserable. I was so hopeless. I wanted to die because I couldn't get out of that lifestyle that I was in. I couldn't stop using. I couldn't stop leaving my kids at home by themselves, leaving the oldest one to look after the youngest one. I couldn't eat. I couldn't get to work and stay there and focus on work. You know, I was manipulating the time card. So I don't know what they call that, but it's a crime. That's what it is. Thank you. And what was interesting was that I worked at the Pentagon, and I worked in the office of the they were the Drug and Alcohol Abuse Control Office. And all this literature used to come in there about substance abuse and drug abuse and everything. And I would read it and I would think, my ex-husband, I would think this about him. He got a problem after I read it, right? He really needs some help. And I would miss days, and I would tell him I couldn't come to work because he was doing this. I couldn't come to work because he got locked up. I just couldn't, you know, I was putting everything on him. One day I went into work, it was a Monday, and this major said, Brenda, you look like you've been up smoking cocaine all weekend long. And I'm like, how did he know? Because my jaws were sunken in, my head beams was beaming, you know. I looked a mess, and I probably stunk, too. And, but at that time, I also had a boyfriend. I had a husband at home and a boyfriend who was the person that introduced me to treatment. When I came in there, he said, you need some help. and I'm going to help you. And he talked about taking me to a place to get some help. And it was after me and my ex had had a really bad fight. And so I was ready. And he made some calls and finally got me to, got them to say, found a treatment for me. And that was at 8 o'clock when he started calling. By 3, I had talked to the ex. And by 5, when it was time to go, I was like, look, I got to go take care of my children. You know? He said, if you don't go now, you'll never go. And something about the way he said that made me want to go to treatment. And I went to treatment that night. And I went in there, and I had my first meeting. And the first meeting I went to, I called my husband at the time, and I told him where I was. And him and my brother showed up at that first meeting. And when I saw them at halftime, I said, I was going to get my 24-hour chip. And I said, get them too, because they use. And they said, it's not for those that want it. It's not for those that need it. It's for those that want it. You know, and people were bringing meetings in there, and I heard, why are we here? And they talked about, you know, how we were no good for our family, our wives, our husbands, and our children. And I felt like somebody wrote that story about, I mean, that literature about me. And I heard it, and it penetrated in me because I wasn't any kind of mother. I wasn't any kind of daughter or wife. And I heard in that meeting, in that treatment center, that you have a disease that's incurable, that you need some help. And I was in that treatment center for 30 days. And in between, I had never seen Michael Jackson live. And I had never seen Prince live. But I had tickets to go see both of them while I was in treatment. And I told them, I need to go to this concert. I'll be back. You know? They was like, no, if you leave, you're not coming back. Something about that scared me, too. And I didn't leave. And I did not see Michael Jackson live. And I didn't see Prince live. And I stayed in that treatment center, and I kept going to meetings. The only thing that I didn't do was tell them honestly what I thought. You know, and I wouldn't tell them that, yeah, y'all say he's a trigger, and he ain't nothing but a big bag of dope and a bag of coke to you. But I wouldn't say that out loud. That's my husband. How y'all going to tell me stay away from him? You know, and he ain't going to get me high. I wasn't verbalizing that. But I was getting ready to leave that treatment for something. I can't remember what it was for the second time. And this lady, I said, I need to go take care of my children. And she said, you ain't been no kind of mother. So why would you leave now? You ain't going to be one when you leave here. And she pissed me off because she told me the truth, you know. And I got out of there, and they told me go to meetings, and that's what I've been doing ever since. They told me something in treatment, too, and I hold on to this very day, and that's talk about you. When you hurting, talk about you. Let people know what's on your mind. For the first 5 years, I know I came into rooms many a times, and I said, I'm Brenda, I'm an addict, and I feel like using today, because that thing wouldn't let up off of me for a long time. I remember one time I told my sponsor, I said, I'm the only one sharing about it. I feel like I'm using. My sponsor said, don't worry, people thinking it. You know, and that was good. You know, but you keep sharing it. You keep talking about it. You know, go to a lot of meetings, get in service, get involved. And most of all, start working on yourself. They said you can have a castle or a hut in here. You know, it's all up to you. But you got to play a part in your recovery. And I still have to play a part in my recovery today. I got on the journey with the steps. I really, really, really didn't want to use anymore. But I really, really, really didn't know how to stop on my own. And I needed y'all. You know, and I had to admit the powerlessness, that I am powerless over that little bag, you know, and that my life is totally unmanageable. I don't bathe. I don't brush my teeth. I don't go to the doctors. I don't take care of my children. Nothing matters but using. Nothing. I put nothing first using had to come first. And in here, y'all told me staying clean has to come first. You know, what do you do? What lengths are you willing to go through to stay clean? And I was willing to do what was ever necessary for me to do to not use. It got to that point where I wanted to be clean. You know, I wanted to try something. They say, you already know what's back there. Try for the unknown, you know. And so I had to do those things that I wasn't familiar with doing. And that, like I said, talking about myself, letting y'all know what's going on with me. Y'all gave me a lot of hope. And one of the things that really gave me some hope was seeing my sponsor in the rooms, because I knew my sponsor on the streets. And I heard how bad my sponsor was. You know, so to see my sponsor clean for 3 years was awesome for me. And if I knew how bad my sponsor was and my sponsor got it, then I could get it. You know, and so my sponsor told me what I needed to do, started guiding me through the steps. Get in service, Brenda. One of my first service positions was a chairperson at my home group. And it was a good position. Man, I was so, I came in there one time. You know, I like to be seen back then. I ain't too much like that today, but back then I remember, you know, I was chairing this meeting. And I came in there one day, and I thought I was being sexy, so I didn't have a bra on. I had this real low-cut thing on, right? And then I bent over, and I said, oops. And this guy said, you knew that before you left the house. I was like, damn. You know, they call you out on your stuff, right? But what my sponsor told me after that was, you need to go somewhere. You like to be seen. You need to go somewhere where they can't see. You need to go to Upper Marlboro Jail and take the meeting up there, you know. And I've been doing that ever since, you know. And I'm grateful for that, too. But it was important for me not just to be in service to others, but to be in service to myself, and that is to continue to work on myself and getting involved in these steps. And the third step, turning my life and my will over to the care of God, you know, that was one of those steps where the total surrender had to come. You can't do this, Brenda. Your will will get you in trouble and keep you in trouble. You need to allow somebody, something greater than you, to guide you. You know, with that thinking that you had, with that anger that you had, with that frustration, the resentments that you have, you need some guidance. And you need a loving and caring power to guide you through that. And it was without that, I wouldn't have been able to go on with the fourth step. The fourth step, I was so fearful at times about writing what I had to write, because I was going into an area that I had never ventured into, and that was inside a cell. And so I had to keep going back to that third step, asking God for the courage to move on. I finally got that step written. I wrote about stuff that, you know, happened 30, 25 years ago, but it was still causing me some pain and some resentment and some embarrassment and some guilt and some shame. But getting it on paper and freeing myself, man, I cried through that thing. I cried a whole lot. That was freeing for me. But I kept going on. And something kept saying in the back of my mind, what if somebody read it? And then something said, what if they do? They already know. You know, so I had to keep praying and asking God to allow me to go through and finish writing that fourth step. And then meeting with my sponsor to share it. I made two or three appointments with my sponsor to do that fifth step. And I kept counseling them because that fear kept cropping in. I was getting ready to do something else, be intimate with somebody, with some real intimate stuff. The first steps was okay to share with my sponsor. But there's some deep stuff here. And so, you know, I was telling them, I can't make it. I have to do this. I have to do that. The last time my sponsor said, you ain't canceling this meeting no more. We're going to go on. We're going to do this step. And we did that step. And I'm so grateful that I went on, that I didn't allow fear to trap me from doing what I needed to do. And in that meeting, you know, a lot of things were exposed to me, my character defects. You know, my assets, it was some. Mm-hmm. My defects was longer. And the ones that my sponsor considered glaring, I didn't agree. Like petty and controlling. I still have a problem with that. But the reality is, those are some of my most glaring defects. And that they were identified by somebody. See, I didn't think y'all really knew what the inside of me was about, but y'all saw it long before I knew what was going on. And so I'm glad. And my sponsor told me at that meeting, too, when I did my fifth step, you ain't even halfway through the program. This is a 12-step program. You need to go through the program. And so I went on, did the rest of my steps with my sponsor at 6 and 7, and I believe they work together because those defects are so, the longer I'm here, the more I have to work on, you know, and the more I have to give to God. The more I have to trust that God, if I do his will, then it's going to be all right. And stop trying to manipulate situations, Brenda. Stop trying to make the outcome what you would have it to be instead of what God wants it to be. You know, and it's something that's, that you always have to, I always have to remain humble because I'm still subject to be that same person that I was when I came in here, if I'm going to have it my way. Eighth step, making that list, that was easy because I had to take most of them from the fourth step. And one of the things that was tough with that eighth step was it was a person on that list that harmed me. And I didn't want to put that person down. And I had to call my sponsor. And my sponsor said, you got to put that person on the list. You got to forgive them. That's what you have to do. And I want to get better. So I do what my sponsor suggested I do. And I started praying for that person and realizing that person was sick. And the other thing my sponsor said is, you're going to want some forgiveness too. So you need to do that. And I was able to complete that list. And go on to the ninth step. The ninth step to me was one step that truly got me closer to God, especially when I had to go sit with another individual and talk about me and make amends for my part, not their part, my part. Forget what they did. You do you, you know, and don't have no expectations. And one of the toughest ones was my father, going to make amends to him. And it took me a few attempts. And I had opportunities. But the coward kept showing up and wouldn't allow me to make them amends. And I remember going to a meeting sharing that I had one more opportunity, and I didn't do it. And I felt like such a failure. The other thing that happened during that process was even though I felt that way, I kept praying. But this guy told me that once I shared about failing to make that amends again, he said, Brenda, he said, courage is not absent of fear. It's going on in spite of. You know, so you won't be scared, but keep walking. Keep walking towards your mark, you know. And I was finally able to do that amends. And that was, man, me and my father are the best of friends today. I love my dad, you know. And 10, the daily maintenance. Keep looking at Brenda. Keep looking at the good, the inventory, the good and the bad. You know, take that pamphlet, Live in the Program. Read it, you know. Read your literature. Stay spiritually strong. You know, do what you need to do to maintain this recovery. Because it ain't just a given. Just because you got 20 years, Brenda, you don't mean you're going to keep it if you stop doing what you're supposed to do. You know, and the prayer and meditation, you know, I still today am not where I would like to be. But I'm still trying. I'm still practicing, you know. And that's a good thing. Service. I haven't been out of service since I've been clean. I don't intend on getting out of service. I still go to that same jail that I went to in 1989 on H&I. Anybody don't have service, please do H&I. That's the best service in the world, right? The steps is my experience. The steps are what got me through sometimes when my mother-in-law was sick. And taking care of her, my experience with that is you can hurt and you can still serve and you can help someone transition, you know, and you don't have to use, no matter how bad your gut hurt. You know, I remember crying to my sponsor that she had Oxycontin. And I was telling everybody, the way that stuff make her look, I want just a quarter of what she had. I ain't have to have the whole thing. Just a little piece. And I shared it, and I shared it. And finally, I even shared it at James' anniversary. Because someone I loved was leaving me. You know, and I was powerless, and I couldn't do anything about it but be there. And my sponsor said, Brenda, the most simplest thing, Brenda, that's her medicine. Yeah. And it went away. You know, the simplicity, you know, to go through some things. It's good things. My daughter, the one that when she was a few months old, and I was, all of my negotiables were gone, and she was there left on the floor, and I wanted to give her away. Some family could have took care of, they could have paid me for her, though. But, you know, that's what my thinking was. I didn't do it, thank God. But she's graduating from college on Mother's Day because Narcotics Anonymous made it possible for me to be there for her. You know, and if she ain't doing no finished business for me. She did that for herself. But my sponsor told me, stick and stay with her. You know, it's going to be some tough times. You're going to have to hold her up. I've been there for her. I've been a mother. I have a husband. I'm a wife, you know. This program has just been awesome. It tells me no matter what you go through, Brenda, good, bad, or indifference, you don't have to use no matter what. You keep coming back, and you try to help the dummy. The dummy's you, by the way, Brenda. Don't ever forget that. You still need the most help. I know that today. That's why I still go to meetings. That's why I have a home group, which is Steps to Life group, on Thursday nights at 8 o'clock. Come and visit us sometime on Bach Road in Oxon Hill. That's why I stay involved. That's why I stay plugged in, because I don't want to ever use again no matter what, you know. And I really want to thank this the program committee for this convention, and I want to thank y'all for being here, and I want to thank my sponsees that are here too, as well as my sponsor and my network. And I love you all, and thank you for letting me share.